KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And if you like horror movies and you spend time in L.A., then, you know, the ultimate nightmare is to drive in Los Angeles. And my guest, Jeremy Unger, has made his first feature film about that experience of driving in the streets of L.A. at night. His film is Ride. And first of all, Jeremy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's fun because there are so many film references in it, including the characters quoting films in it, including a memorable quote from a Martin Scorsese film that I won't give away here. But I'll just say it's a quote that Martin Scorsese actually offers in a film just to sort of tease viewers with listeners with it. And talk a little bit about your cast. You got Will Brill and Jesse Usher and Bella Thorne. Who did you go to first with it?
So Will Brill and I went to college together. And okay. I actually sort of did a short film to prove that I could do the feature.
You did a short version of it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'd written the script and then I kind of condensed the opening into 15 pages that I could shoot as a short. And I did that with Will Brill and two other fantastic actors, Ian Harding and Mimi Giannopoulos. And then based on that, I went to financiers and, you know, sort of pitched myself to direct this feature. And one of the things that was really important to me was being able to keep Will in that role, because I thought it was, I sort of wrote it with him in mind and I thought he was so well suited to it. So that was kind of a big, exciting thing for us to be able to do that.
In what way? Because he's almost like the classic sort of like thriller shapeshifter type villain in this. So what were his strengths that you wanted to write to?
Well, I think Will is just, he's a theater actor and I think his chops are really, really incredible. But also Will has this quality that when you hang out with Will, you just feel kind of cool. And I wrote this very manipulative character, and I think his key to manipulating people is by making them believe the thing they want to believe about themselves. And so there's this kind of gratitude that they have to this character that I think is hopefully subconscious on the part of the characters that he's manipulating. But he just kind of has this coolness that that makes the Bruno manipulative tactics really kind of feel effortless.
And also, too, he's really good at creating false intimacy.
Yeah, completely. That was something I really wanted to try to do in the dialogue, was bring out these things where he could give a little compliment that would seem really authentic, but hopefully we as the audience can tell that there's something underneath it, that it's motivated by something.
If you would, explain for the audience what the movie's about.
Okay, so Ride is a thriller set during the course of one night in an Uber, and it's all on the streets of Los Angeles.
Well, you said Uber type Viva. I hope you trademarked Ride as an app, because the app is called Ride.
The app is called Ride in the film, but it's that sort of Uber, Lyft, rideshare style experience. And it's the main character of the film is a driver named James, who's played by Jesse Usher. And James is kind of your quintessential LA actor who's driving between jobs to pay the bills. And at the beginning of the film, he picks up a girl played by Bella Thorne, and he's driving her to a bar, and they have this kind of low-key romantic encounter where at the end of the ride, she invites him in for a drink. But he has to keep driving and he's a little too shy to get her phone number. And then the next person he picks up is this kind of charismatic, charming sociopath who ingratiates himself into the driver's life and keeps kind of pushing the boundaries just a little bit in terms of take me a couple of different places, do this and this and this, until finally he convinces him to go back to the bar and find the girl. And once the three of them are in the car, things take a dark twist.
Yeah, and we can't talk about this movie without talking about some of the obvious nods to Collateral, right down to James almost wearing the same suit that Tom Cruise is wearing in the movie.
Yes. I really love Michael Mann, and it's so funny because I feel like I really made a movie that so parallels Collateral. And I was thinking about Thief the entire time I was writing it, which was just, I don't know, an odd thing for me. And even if you look, I made a deck of visual reference and the kind of package that I used to try to set the movie up.
The way you shoot the night is very close to the way Michael Mann shoots nighttime in Thief.
Yeah. I really loved Thief and loved the way there are certain shots of reflections in Thief that were really kind of inspiring to me. And then also, I loved the soundtrack of Thief. It was by Tangerine Dream.
Yeah.
And actually, the guy who composed the music for Ride is a guy named Paul Hasslinger, who was in Tangerine Dream and great composer.
How'd you get him?
You know, I'd been talking to a couple of people and I knew that I wanted this electronic score. And I sent the film to Paul kind of, you know, on a whim to see if he would like it. And he responded to it. And we sat down and it just kind of became clear when we were talking that this was the guy.
It's interesting, too, because in watching your film and thinking about Collateral, I was reminded of how much Collateral is so similar to also to Strangers on a Train.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Hitchcock is the director that made me want to become a filmmaker. I think when I really think about it, I grew up in Los Angeles. I love movies from the time I was, you know, super young. But I remember, you know,
compared to now when you're just young.
Yeah. but like being like 8 years old or whatever and watching old episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and being so taken by some of these like incredible half hour pieces of television that he made. And then Strangers on a Train, I think, was one of a really early favorite films for me. And Ride, I think the first thing that I thought was, well, what if I tried to write something like Strangers on a Train in an Uber? And I really wanted with the first movie to be able to try to do something that was uniquely contemporary, but in which I could try to use some storytelling tactics that are older and that we don't kind of get to see quite as often. Things like super long takes, things like my background as a director is in theater, and so I really wanted to be able to work the scenes kind of like you would a play.
Well, it's in effect, for the most part, it's a three-hander, which means it could almost be a stage play.
Yeah. It's funny also, when I wrote it, I showed it to some people, and people would say, hey, you ever think about doing this as a play? And I would actually be interested in adapting it to a play now, but initially I really wanted to do. I think contained movies are so cool, and if you handle them right, they can be more cinematic than something that's more open, because the way you have to be inventive with the camera can create some kind of great different things. And I think I really like restriction. I really respond well to working with restriction. And I think this being contained made me a little bit more nimble and have to be a little more creative with how we approach certain visual things.
I guess as you're talking about this, I found myself as I was watching it too, thinking of Rope.
Yes. Rope was a huge, really early favorite movie of mine, and also just something where, you know, I think those performances are so great. And that was a stage play that Hitchcock adapted. And it's just the way he handles the camera in that contained space is so, so cinematic. That just the moves and the way he, you know, keeps the one shot thing going with those inventive pull-ups. And there's one moment in Rope that's one of my favorite moments, I think, in movies, which is when sorry if you haven't seen Rope, but at the end when they reveal the body, and it's in this chest, and the camera is pushing in and they pull up the chest, it opens, and it blocks the camera, which is this trope that we've kind of seen where every time they need to change a reel, they'll go in behind someone's jacket or whatever.
Or behind a pillar or something like that, yeah.
And so they block the camera with the chest and change the reel. And then when they boom up, for the first time in the movie, they also change lenses. And so you're on this much tighter angle on, I think it's Jimmy Stewart's face, when you come up from the thing. And it's just the most kind of amazing use of setting up this specific rule for your movie and then changing it in the last second to make this really impactful kind of crazy shot.
It's the Spoiler Alert Show, also known as The Treatment. My guest is first-time director Jeremy Unger's first film is Ride. It's also interesting, too, because I found myself thinking about the way you use close-ups. I mean, once we're inside that car, to create tension, you get us really close to the faces. I mean, early on, you're a little farther back, as you're just letting us get to know James and Jesse.
Yeah.
and Bruno and... You just, so you're hanging back a little bit, right? Just sort of give the audiences a chance to sort of to move slowly and closer with these characters too, right?
Yeah. And I think the close-up was a really kind of powerful tool for us eventually. But those medium shots early on also, you know, we shot anamorphic, and that was something that was really important to me.
I was wondering why you might not want to try to do almost like Academy, like a box to sort of make it really close and tense.
You know, it's funny. I love Academy ratio, and I'd love to do a movie in it someday. But I was really clear that I wanted to do, you know, 2:40 for this because it kind of perfectly fits the shape of a car window. And
the windshield especially, sure.
Yeah, the windshield and the mirror. And there was a lot of stuff I wanted to play with that. And so I think it let us have these kind of two shots, especially in this very horizontal space like a car, where I could play with tableau a little bit more in a way that, you know, felt Hitchcockian and felt like, I mean, another director I really love is Kurosawa, who uses a ton of, you know, kind of medium shots and more pulled back things. And then, you know, once things, like you said, do get more intense, some of those close-ups where we got just, you know, really tight on Will's eyes or whatever it is, you know, I think were more impactful because we lived in that medium space for a while.
And I was thinking, too, about the way you shot the car phone. I was still thinking about a lot of the shots that David Fincher uses in Seven, and the way he uses sort of that car as kind of a prison for Morgan Freeman. There's a shot where Jesse is sort of leaning against the window that almost reminded me of a shot from Seven.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's incredible. I'm a huge David Fincher fan, and I actually, our colorist on Ride has colored, I think, every Fincher movie since The Social Network. And my last job as a production assistant, because when I, you know, finished college, I worked as a PA for a couple of years. And my last job was as an office PA on The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I remembered so vividly going to this color house, this amazing place called Light Iron, which was where they did that movie. And I went and dropped a drive there as a production assistant. And then a couple of years later, I went back and I realized, oh, this is the same place that I had come as a PA running a drive. And now I'm back with my movie.
Because I just found myself thinking, too, that the car gets smaller and smaller with your lens choices as the movie goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah. That was definitely a thing of wanting to kind of isolate the characters more. And another thing that I think really contributed that is something I'm kind of fascinated by is the landscape of lights in LA. Specifically, you know, we used to have all these beautiful sodium vapor lights that have that incredible amber glow. And now we're phasing them out for LED lights, which is, you know, a good thing environmentally speaking, and a mixed blessing in terms of the visuals. Because at the beginning of the film in Hollywood, you're under these super bright lights and you have this kind of more vibrant and less eerie vibe. And then as the film goes on, the film basically takes place on Sunset Boulevard the entire night, driving from Hollywood
east to west.
Yeah, Hollywood to the beach sort of thing.
To the end of Sunset.
Yeah, exactly. And so on that drive, you just get a lot more sodium vapors as you go. And so I wanted the movie to live in this color space where it was really bright and kind of white and hot at the beginning. And then you move into these kind of warm tones and this more kind of eerie, you don't quite know what's outside the windows sort of world, you know, later in the movie.
Well, talk too about having James be dressed up in this, because that's a really interesting visual choice to make, because it makes him seem like a very formal, almost like an outsider in LA in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, and James is, you know, when I think about the two male characters in the movie, James is an LA transplant and Bruno is an LA native. And I think those are two kind of specific types of relationship that you have with the city. And the reason James is wearing a suit was, one, I just thought it would be really cool to have him wear a character in a suit in a contemporary movie. And it kind of goes to that wanting to evoke something Hitchcockian.
And kind of glamorous, too.
Yeah. And I mean, Jesse's just the type of guy who looks good in a suit also. So that worked well. But the reason I scripted the suit was that I thought, as a struggling actor in LA, he'd be coming from an audition, and it would be one of those auditions where, you know, for some one reason or another, he was doing a Mad Men type of thing, and you had to wear a suit, and then he went straight to driving. And that's something that comes up a few times in the movie of why are you wearing the suit? And at one time, he's candid about it, and another time, he's a little more restrained about it, because as a struggling artist, there's nothing worse than talking about what you do when you're not doing well.
Or when you're not doing it.
or when you're struggling, you know, it's when things seem to not be going well, I think it's really something that kind of plagues you.
Well, we're going to take a little bit of a break. My guest is Jeremy Unger. His first film as director and writer is Ride. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about Driving in L.A. and Hitchcock and Kurosawa and Fincher and a bunch of other things with the director and writer of the film, Jeremy Unger. I guess I was going to say, too, one of the things I wanted to ask you about with the Bruno character is you make him an audience in a way. I mean, he's an audience and he even gets Jesse to kind of open up and talk about what she is in a way that sort of suggests that he really wants to listen to people.
Yeah, there's something, I mean, I come from a theater background, and so in writing this, I was really kind of inspired by certain playwrights that I think just handle the anatomy of a moment, and specifically the anatomy of manipulation really well. And I mean, the two playwrights that I think, I was thinking about this on the way over here, probably are the most influential on me would be Eugene O'Neill and August Wilson.
Which they talk about dreams a lot, and dreams deferred and failed dreams in those plays.
Yeah, I mean, specifically with O'Neill, The Iceman Cometh was I mean, Bruno is kind of the two things that inspired me to write him were Bruno from Strangers on a Train and Hickey from The Iceman Cometh. And in The Iceman Cometh, Hickey has this monologue that kind of I paraphrased a little bit earlier about how he can manipulate people. And he says, you know, you find out what their pipe dream is, and then you pretend to believe the thing they want to believe about themselves. And then because he's a salesman, he's like, they're great. They're so grateful they want to buy something from you.
But it's also kind of the operating definition of what being a sociopath is, too.
Yeah. And kind of being able to do that and not care about the fact that you're kind of hurting these people by making them, by lying to them.
But also in that way that Hickey is an outsized presence around these people who are little, who aren't as big a presence as he. Bruno occupies more space in this piece than the other characters do. At least in sort of figurative terms, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, maybe part of that is also because I just really, you know, I think when I started writing this, with a project, when I look at if I'm going to start it and how I'm going to approach it, there's a little bit of a courtship phase where you start to work on it and you are still figuring out whether it's the thing that you're actually going to spend 3 years of your life or however long working on. And the thing for me that I kind of fell in love with and made me think like, yeah, I can do this for 3.5 years. And this is the thing that I want to kind of put all the eggs into this basket for the first feature was that when I started writing the Bruno dialogue, it was a voice that kind of surprised me and that I really, really enjoyed writing.
Because
I think of myself as a fairly nice guy. And I was pretty surprised that I could write this really kind of manipulative, sharp and unempathetic dialogue. And then it became something that was just very appealing to work on. And, you know, I'm super interested in manipulation. And I think one of the big themes I wanted to dive into in this movie was how technology makes us susceptible to manipulation. And so I really wanted to make the app feel like a character too. And the, you know, the GPS instructions
are something that
happened throughout. Yeah, we got this amazing voice actress named Kari Wahlgren, who's on Rick and Morty and on X-Men show. She plays Emma Frost, and I asked for an amalgamation of the kind of British Emma Frost accent and the computer from Rick and Morty, and that was what we ended up with. But I really wanted the app to be manipulating James and kind of to be something that made him susceptible to being manipulated by a manipulative person, because I think that's something that happens to us these days that we really don't realize. Like, I think our phones are kind of slowly crushing us, but they're also just so much fun that it's impossible to care.
Wow. Okay, that's a terrifying thought. I'm glad my phone is off right now so it can't hear any of this.
Yeah.
But I found myself, the reason I brought up the idea that he's the ideal audience is that in some ways he's almost directing scenes with them. He starts to talk to James about what his future should be with Jesse. He should go get this girl and these things he should do with her. And then in the car, he actually gets them to stage kind of a movie moment when they're, I don't want to give that scene away, but he gets them to get out of the car. And it's in this weird way, this thing that you kind of dream about, because you want to have the, if you're walking around LA, you want to be in the movies, you want to find these movie moments you can evoke in your life. And Bruno just kind of finds this way that immediately kind of targets this need in both of them, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you say that, because I haven't thought about it on those terms, but it makes me think that like, maybe there's something in this character that's a little bit of a reflection of what I was trying to do, because something that I did want to do was kind of pilfer all of these amazing moments that I've loved from cinema, whether it's, you know, something as specific as the taxi driver monologue or something as kind of general as the fact that, you know, I love it in movies when people say, if this were a movie, this would happen. And that's something that happens in the scene you were talking about. And I think maybe in the same way that Bruno's trying to, you know, make these characters live out these iconic things, I wanted to do a movie where I could really engage with kind of what I've loved from cinematic history and remix it a little bit.
But doesn't it become part of your life if you're in the film world in L.A.? Like you're talking about, you're constantly looking at things and thinking, wow, this would be a great place to stage a movie, or this is a movie moment. And for somebody to be somebody like Bruno, that character, to have that kind of those kind of antennae out, because you say not empathetic, but I think in his way he is. It's just that it's an empathy that's completely self-serving, if there can be such a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, that's another kind of going to the Iceman Cometh thing. It's a Hickey parallel, because I think Hickey in the Iceman Cometh, I think, really believes that he wants to help these people. And the lie that he's told himself is that he has it all figured out. And the truth is that he doesn't at all. And that's kind of revealed in his breakdown at the end of the play. Spoilers again, sorry.
It's the treatment. My guest who's now ruining Eugene O'Neill for all of you is Jeremy Unger, whose first film as writer-director is Ride. But I find myself thinking about this too, just because there's so much in those scenes between the three of them that at a certain point it's about them breaking that spell too. And it's almost like they're kind of in this cult in this weird way, where he creates this kind of spell over them, and then they have to get out because there's immediate danger to them, certainly, but also they like it. I mean, they like this space that he's put them in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's something that I really, and I think when I was writing it, I thought a lot about how kind of frustrating we can get into these phases of our life where we just do the thing that's the most expected thing for us to do. And it can really take the magic out of life a little bit. And you know, as we get older, everything becomes less, incrementally less magical. It's like, you know, when you're a kid, it's all fresh and new and wonderful. And I think something that maybe the part of me that would want to defend Bruno would argue that he's trying to give these two people an experience that makes L.A. magical again and makes their life, you know, feel interesting and feel like possibilities are open.
It's interesting because I thought about it as I was watching that line between excitement and chaos, that he kind of lives on that kind of razor's edge, if you will, of and not being able, or even interested, rather, I should say, in separating those two things, the difference between that they one feeds off the other. And that seems to be kind of his makeup as a character, at least to me.
Yeah, that's, I think, right on the money. And I think that's something that kind of power is addictive. And that was, you know, I wrote these pretty intense character bios that I only shared with the actor before the, you know, before shooting. And one of the things from the Bruno bio that was really kind of interesting to me is that, you know, I talked about the LA native. Bruno is an LA native, but I think he's a kind of really specific type of, you know, very privileged kid who grew up in LA and really quickly got used to being able to get everything that he wants. And I don't mean from a perspective of having it necessarily handed to him, but from a perspective of being
a hustler.
To hustle, to control people, to do these things. And I think once you have that, it takes more and more to kind of create something interesting to you. And so he's at the, you know, maybe earlier in his life, he would have been happy, you know, going out for a night and finding a girl and maybe making out with her at the bar or whatever. And that would have been a good Bruno night. But now it's like the return of that is long gone. And he's got to, you know, find some people and terrorize them in order to feel alive.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost like a classic kind of thriller thing. And the reason I said shapeshift at the very beginning is that in each act, he's kind of a different person. And I was wondering if that was something you charted out for him, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I kind of remain conflicted on with this character is how much, because I think even when he's doing the manipulative stuff, in order to be good at it, he has to kind of believe it. He has to kind of, you know, watch the Richard II monologue and feel like James is someone who's, you know, worth saving and kind of in his warped sense of what saving is.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's looking for, in his way, he's looking for art. You know, he's looking for he's looking to find people who are worthy of his time.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's something I really wanted to have in the movie. This concept of engaging with other kinds of art, like it was really important to try to have a Shakespeare monologue and a dance sequence and a jazz standard sung in the car, and these kind of things that I thought you don't really see in movies that often these days. And that, you know, that when I wrote, I also thought, geez, when I find financiers for this, they're going to make me cut the Shakespeare right away. And I was very fortunate to have, I think, some very brave producers who were unintimidated by that and responded to the more risky, you know, let's just have someone drive and recite Shakespeare for 3 minutes.
I also have an actor who can respond to that too. And I wonder, we talked a bit about, well, to talk to you a bit about casting Bella.
Oh, yeah.
And Jesse in the film too. Well,
Bella was the first actress that came into the film. And I remember so vividly sitting down with her. And she's like one of the most unique people I've ever met. And she's, I think the key to the thing that makes Bella so interesting and cool is that she's candid and authentic to a degree that is like rivaled by no one I've ever met. And so I remember sitting down with her and being like, okay, this girl's so cool and also so LA. And it was clear to me that she would kind of bring the right amount of herself to the text, that it would result in something that, you know, I think would feel authentic and also would feel just like a true person you would meet on a night out in LA. And then when it came to meeting with Jesse, that role was a really tricky one to cast because I think James kind of possesses a lot of the qualities that I hope to possess as a person. I think he's inherently kind. I think he's intensely optimistic. I think it in a way that sometimes makes him naive, he's optimistic. And then also, I think there's kind of a restrained strength to James that's there in everything that he does. And I think balancing that being naive and, you know, able to be manipulated, but also with this kind of real masculinity and strength is a tricky thing. And I remember sitting down with Jesse Usher and having a conversation with him about doing theater when he was a kid, and then talking about, you know, the fact that we're both Steelers fans and just these, you know, whatever it was, that came through. Like, Jesse has an undeniable kindness and then also a real strength. And I think from the moment I sat down with him, it was just clear to me that this was the guy.
What's fascinating about this, and just sort of thematic terms, it's really about people who want to be heard. I mean, literally want to be heard and seen, isn't it?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Including with Bruno.
Yeah. I mean, Bruno definitely wants to be heard. And it's an interesting thing because he's so silver-tongued and so kind of has this way about him where he can take the focus in the room. But I don't think that necessarily means being heard. You know, you can talk and talk and talk and not actually communicate something.
That's why he basically has to take the people he wants to hear him hostage, because he literally demands an audience.
Yeah. Even if it means holding them at gunpoint. Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought that was the fascinating thing about it, that, you know, this is this guy who, just by sheer dint of personality, probably could be the kind of person who holds court and would be paid attention to. But to put him in that kind of situation and sort of just say that he has to do this, I thought was a really fascinating turn.
Thank you very much.
I mean, because this could be an incredibly lopsided piece, and especially if he's just talking all the time. So it's about him understanding where the pressure points are on people, and right down to being able to sort of tell them, James, how to get into this club. I mean, he seems to kind of know almost the right thing to say at all times. And if James weren't as kind of willfully naive as you're talking about, he would say, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah. And that was a tricky line to walk for me in the writing of the piece of, you know, how far can Bruno take it and how much can he push and how much can he tip his hand without having, because there's always, you know, I think in good drama that a scene could end at any moment. And in Ride, Bruno could get bored and leave, or James could be like, listen, man, you got to get out of my car right now. And that was, I think, the fun writing challenge for me was in each of those early scenes, dropping just enough of a reason for James to keep driving Bruno and for Bruno to want to stay in the car, to be interested enough by this guy to think that he might be a good project for the night.
There's clearly a lot to talk about with this first movie, but we're out of time. So all I can do right now is thank you for being here. Thanks so much,
Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. My guest is Jeremy. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And the film's fun, too. My guest is the writer and director of the film Ride, Jeremy Unger. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Ewer. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's also associate producer. I'm not getting in a ride share anytime soon. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.